Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Clarence Carter, Director of the District of Columbia's Department of Human Services. Also joining us from IBM is Stuart Vansky. Clarence, what have been the effects of the current economic downturn on your programs and clients, and how are you dealing with higher applications and increasing caseloads while facing significant budget reductions?
Michael, I had mentioned that we've seen a 51% increase in homeless families over the course of the last 18 months. We've also had about an 8% increase in our temporary assistance for needy families caseload, about a 20% increase in our food stamp caseloaders, and about a 13% increase in our Medicaid caseload. So all across the board for all of our supports, there has been a significant increase in application and utilization of these safety net programs. And it has been a real challenge in this very resource-constrained time. But we've done some pretty creative things. We had, when I began, 7 service centers, and we were spending about $30 million annually in bricks and mortar. And quite frankly, a building never fed anybody. And so one of the things that we've done is we've reconfigured our service center mix and gotten out of some of those leases so we could be able to not reduce our programs and services. And so we have been able to, in this very resource-constrained time, although we've had to reduce our budget over the last 3 years, each year for the last 3 years, we have been able, for the most part, to not impact programs because we were able to be creative and put the resources in basically serving the people. But there has been a significant increase in utilization of these programs over the course of this period of time.
Now, some of the stats you've mentioned, I think you had mentioned a 51% increase in homeless families. I hasten to ask, but do you see any signs of turnaround in this regard? And are things getting better or are they stabilizing?
For our other benefit programs, the SNAP program, the TANF program, the Medicaid, and the Alliance, there does seem to be some slowdown in the rate of growth. Now, this homeless family issue, it seems to still be trending upward. We think there may be some light at the end of the tunnel, but we've not seen the turnaround just yet.
And you mentioned earlier, Clarence, that the federal level, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, provided some additional funds to the district in human service delivery. To what extent has any of the programs that you lead leveraged Recovery Act funding? And how are you tracking and reporting on some of the transparency and accountability requirements associated with that money?
We have leveraged the 2 opportunities that are available to the Department of Human Services. I spoke a little bit about the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Initiative. That was $7.5 million that was available to the district that has allowed us to divert some families and individuals from homelessness, okay, and then to help also house some folks. And in addition to HPRP, through the Recovery Act, there was an augment to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which would allow jurisdictions to earn about half of their annual grant for increases in caseload and spending on social and economically challenged individuals and families. And so our annual TANF grant is about $92 million. So we were able to earn an additional $46 million through the Recovery Act. And so we are in the process of, we've submitted application to the feds for the first portion of that, have received $23 million of that. And so we think that by the end of this year, we will have drawn down a full $46 million that would not have been available to us without the Recovery Act. And the way that The mayor has created a centralized reporting process for all ERA expenditures. So we are required to report every dime of this that we expend, and the district pretty aggressively reports each dollar spent and what it was that was done with those dollars.
Earlier, you mentioned a little bit about the department's Income Maintenance Administration's service centers and how you reconfigure this. Can you explain a little bit more about the services provided at these centers and what you've done to enhance customer service, streamline the workflow, and make things better for clients?
Sure, Stuart. At our Income Maintenance Service Centers, of course, individuals can apply for the complete suite of benefit programs that are eligible through Department of Human Services, and that would be, of course, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, the SNAP program, the Medicaid program, or the District Universal Health Care program, the Alliance. Also, there's an interim disability program, a child care subsidy program, so you can apply for all of those benefit programs through a service center. And also, of course, everything that you would need to do to recertify to continue to receive those benefits where you're still eligible for them. And as you can imagine, with the kinds of caseload increases that we talked to you about, we have seen some dramatic increase in utilization of those service centers. So we've developed some tools, some tracking tools, which would allow our service center managers to be able to predict trends and spikes in utilization to be able to redeploy staff to try to address some of those circumstances. And now we are in the process of developing an electronic single point of entry, which would allow for an individual to access the district's benefits, goods, and services through the internet, through phone, through the mail, through kiosk, so that in the very near future, an individual will never have to enter a service center in order to be able to receive benefits. It makes no sense in the 21st century why someone has to come to a government building when whether or not they are eligible for these benefits is a simple issue of the exchange of information. And so we are make it so that we can exchange that information through many different mechanisms so that that customer, just like you don't have to go into a bank to receive your money, will not have to go into a service center to be able to receive service in the very near future.
You mentioned earlier we were talking about the fundamental drive of many of these programs, which is towards self-sufficiency, to help clients achieve self-sufficiency, which in many ways means a meaningful job. Would you elaborate on some of the barriers you see today that clients face in finding appropriate employment?
Stuart, first, I would take a little bit of exception with your characterization. We hope as a society, I think, that people would be self-sufficient, but we literally don't design and operate these programs to achieve that objective. And part of my argument is that that's what we need to do. We need to be intentional about these programs being designed and operated to that end. But one of the challenges, significant challenges that we have in the district is many of our customers don't have the remedial skills and abilities to be able to avail themselves of existing training and development opportunities. Most of these, the training and development opportunities that are available require a GED and at least a ninth grade reading level. And many of our customers, many, unfortunately, don't have that very remedial ability. So our challenge is to first get them up to a level where they could avail themselves of the training opportunities for the jobs that are out there. Very much in the district, our customers are almost cemented in poverty because of this not having many of these very remedial skill sets. And so our challenge through assessment and then trying to grow their capacity to be able to meet these minimum skill levels is to get them to the place where they then can take advantage of training and development opportunities that would allow them to get meaningful employment. But we have to get them up to that basic level first. And that provides for us the basic challenge to reducing poverty in the district.
And that's a fundamental element of your reform vision.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is, yes.
And Clarence, performance management, evaluation are important tools to doing a lot of what you're talking about in terms of analyzing the effectiveness of these programs and making a difference. To that end, would you describe your evaluation strategy? How do you assess performance of programs that are under your purview?
And Michael, in all candor, I'm embarrassed to say that we have heretofore, we have not done that well at all. I have developed recently an Office of Accountability and been in the process of reengineering an Office of Information Systems so that we collect the data and do much more rigorous analysis of our programs, that we should be in a position where we plan what we are going to do, we do that, we learn from it and feed that back. We don't have this continuous loop. And so that's what we have built. And I am hoping in the very, very near future, we are going to have a much more rigorous performance management apparatus, which does allow us to learn from what we are doing. But we are in the very infant stages of building that.
So as a follow-up, how do you use or do you use performance-based contracts in order to enable a focus on client outcomes rather than, say, process or unit outputs? Are there any drawbacks to using this?
We actually are with the change in our homeless services system, the revamping of our homeless services system, we are going to this fall performance-based contracts. And the performance, the basis of those performance is going to be growing the capacity of that customer we serve, not simply providing shelter, okay, not simply providing a unit of service, but actually being intentional about growing the capacity of that customer. Now, this is going to be new for us. So the next time we get a chance to chat, I hope I'll be able to give you some more information about how performance-based contracting is working for us. But we think it is an absolute key component to and for performance to be based on growing the capacity of the customer and not simply performance, which is in delivering a unit of service.
So it's a really interesting and integral part of your whole transformation effort.
It absolutely is.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit here and talk about some recent history, the unfortunate Benita Jacks case, which was a tragedy that made national headlines. Would you elaborate on the working relationship with other city social services agencies that at some assessments was one of the issues involved in the Benita Jacks case, and what's being done to ensure that a tragedy like that never happens again?
The city council passed the Jacks-Fogel legislation, which is a data sharing that would allow us to share information across agencies so that we can better serve clients that have circumstances across our agencies. And that's the first in a number of different mechanisms and protocols that we are developing that will allow us to better operate across programs and across agencies to serve folks. I think the Office of Inspector General did a report following the Jacks tragedy, and one of the things that it laid out was that agencies operated in their own vacuum, and a number of different agencies touched this family, but we didn't do it in concert. Okay? Everybody operated very much in their own lane, and it goes back, from my perspective, to the basic problem I talked about in the human services system. Not only do we have individual program silos, we have individual agency silos with everybody having their own individual authority, okay? And with no one really having authority for the individual or family, okay? And so we are attempting in the district to build a whole new construct which allows us one in instances of crisis to actually have a team which is dedicated to working directly with that family to remediate the crisis, but also working across agencies to coordinate the care so that those individuals or families don't fall through the cracks of our system. So we are attempting, and our person-first model is central to this new system redesign, which will allow us to focus more intentionally on the individual or family and less on the program that we're serving.
Clarence, I wanted to ask you about the kinds of private-public partnerships you engage in at DHS, and how do you see them impacting the outcomes of your programs?
First, we have a pretty robust set of community partnerships because we simply could not do everything that we are required to do by ourselves. Okay? And so there are a number of community-based organizations that DHS partners with to, you know, whether the issue is teen pregnancy or adult protective services or actually case management for a number of the families that we serve, those partnerships help us to be able to deliver those services. And I think at the core of that question has to be an understanding that no government, no agency, no program is in and of itself the silver bullet. If we don't reach out and collectively knit together the community to solve these problems, the whole cannot be greater than the sum of its parts. So we very aggressively use those kinds of partnerships to help us get our work done.
What does the future hold for DC's Department of Human Services? We will ask Clarence Carter, its director, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.